a chance. Go ahead and put in 6 volts. And I know as long as you've got a good list of all the things that you had in memory, and it's not that difficult to restore it, then run an experiment at 3 volts and see if it holds its memory. And I think it will. And so, as long as you can load the data back in again, if you happen to lose it at 3 volts and you have to go back to 5.7, that's not the end of the world. You can run that experiment. A memory function is never going to get damaged by having too small a voltage out of the battery. Because let's face it, every battery is going to go down in voltage as it finally goes dead. And if that created damage, they'd get a lot of flack on that particular design. So there's a couple of experiments he could do, and there's some further investigation. In his case, I would do the experiment at 3 volts and see if it holds its memory. And I'll bet you're going to find out it does. KC2WGB, and you can go to the next one if you want to, John. K2RIW in the Tech Man.
KC2QIQ with a comment?
When you get a chance, then.
Okay, I heard QIQ and another person. Glenn first. Go ahead, Glenn.
Hi, good evening, Dick. When I was listening to the magnet mount question a little bit earlier, and the kid, I guess, was worried about, you know, putting an antenna on his parents' car, the first magnet mount that I thought of that came to mind, it's one of my favorites that you can put on the roof of a car, because it's half magnet mount and half suction cup, and it's a little bit wide and very, very low profile, and really, it's car.
Okay.
And the mount is a K702M magnet mount, and actually how you take it off the car is it has a little tab on the end, and it actually breaks the pressure of the suction cup, and then you can lift the magnet mount off. Really, really cool device, and it's got a lot of surface area, too. It's a 6 3/8 diameter, and it's about 3/4 inch high mount, and it mounts to the PL259 style antennas for VHF and UHF. Really, really cool mount. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
And WS2N, with the websites whenever you want them.
Very fine. Okay, that's good. K702, I think it was, mag mount. Boy, that sounds like a nicely designed thing, Glenn. Thank you. Was there another person who had a comment with reference to the battery, memory battery? Give me your call letters right now. I guess it was you, Paul, WS2N. Go right ahead with the compacted website that'll give us that beautiful picture of the James Webb Infrared Space Telescope. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I don't see it on the home site anymore. Well, that was a year or so ago. So, yeah, here it is. It was a very long URL, so I went to tiny URLs for this compacted one. http://tiny.cc/8swik. So http://tango-india-november-yankee.charlie-charlie-8sierra-whiskey-india-kilo. Okay, that's the tiny URL. Now, on my computer, you know, my other computers, you don't have to put the http://. It'll work from just tiny.cc/8swik. No problem. That'll bring it right up. And then I'll give you the home site, because that's the one with the animation of this thing opening up.
Okay, you made that very clear. I'm pretty sure everybody got that one. Go ahead with the home site, Paul.
Yeah, okay. James Webb Telescope is www.jwst.nasa.gov. www.jamesweb.nasa.gov. Now, when you go to that, you'll see choices on the left-hand side. You know, it's written in yellow, a bunch of different things you can choose on. You know, development, this and that. Well, you go to the one that says images. So it's a four-step process to get to what I'm talking about. You go to the home site, www.jwst.nasa.gov. Number two, you go to images, and you left-hand side, you click on images, and you're going to get two choices that are going to pop up. The one you're going to choose is called Animations and Videos. You click on that, and then you're going to see a half a dozen pictures to choose from, and you'll want to pick the one that says Deployment and Extractions. Deployment and Extractions. And there's different ones. There's, you can go like to the 60 megabyte one or the 18 megabyte one. Sometimes they don't work. It says, at the end it says YouTube. I go to the YouTube one and it'll bring it right up. And you can see this origami thing, contraption open up. It's unbelievable. All the shades, how they all open up in parts, and then they eventually divide into five different sections. It's unbelievable. Back to you, Dick.
Wow. 14,000 pounds of hardware. What a machine. That's got to work, Paul. It's going to do real magic if it does work. And did they make it clear? Do you happen to know how they're getting the cryogenics? In other words, in order to get full sensitivity with an infrared detector, you would like the detecting device that makes the picture to be cryogenically cooled. You'd like it to be 4 degrees Kelvin if you could do that. That would take a supply of liquid helium that's boiling away in order to give you that cooling. Well, you aim the right kind of hardware at the coldness of space, and the 3 degree Kelvin background of space is also a refrigerator if you can set it up just right. So I wonder, are they getting that cryogenics by passive techniques, or are they doing it with real ebullient transfer, in other words, a boiling off of liquid helium? I wonder if you happen to know that one, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Well, it's both from what I see. It looks like, you know, probably 90-95%. I don't know that, right? The large part of it is done with the solar shade, you know, protecting the whole system. But yeah, there is cryogenics on board. But it must be. It's designed. They want this thing to last like definitely 10 years. 10 year, no problem. And I'm sure they're going to go beyond that. So whatever it is, they're going to use very little of what they have it on board. I guess it's certain. You know, every now and then, maybe a situation might come up where they're going to need it. It's all done with these sunshades. That's why there's these different levels, layers of sunshade. I think it's five different layers. And each one reduces the temperature, you know. It's all in series. They're putting their whole hopes on the sunshade deal. And you got to see this thing unfurl. I don't know. I mean, this makes curiosity look like a piece of cake. You've seen what that thing looks like. Oh, by the way, curiosity is about 80 million miles out, Dick, so it's getting there. Let me drop it. And they did not do the original mid-course maneuver that they planned. They didn't need it, but they're doing one coming up very shortly. Within a day or two, they're going to fire eight different thrusters different times over a period of, a couple hours, it looks like. And eventually, they're going to slow it down or change, they're going to change the velocity by 12 and a half miles per hour, so enough to put it directly on course for Gale Crater, their landing spot on Mars. Originally, they make sure from the initial launch to miss Mars. This way, the booster that's following it does not have a chance of hitting Mars. But you know, that booster is not got the contamination procedures that Curiosity does. So they don't want that thing to hit Mars. So this thing will be on its way, a more direct flight. They have five or six opportunities in the future to fire their thrusters to again if they need to retune their, you know, their bypass a little bit more. So if need be, there. I did want to mention that. But yeah, check out these websites. It's unbelievable. Well, you already have the picture.
Yeah, looking forward to that origami animation of how that thing folds up, unfolds in space. And they're going to be deploying it. I think it's Lagrange point number 2 of the Sun-Earth system. That's the one that's a million miles out from the Earth, away from the Sun. So it gets a little bit of shielding from the Earth itself, because that Sun is very bright, and on those 5 or 6 shields that are part of James Webb itself, allows it to run colder and colder and see less and less flare light from the Sun. And quite possibly it's got some cryogenics on board. But if they got a 10-year life, I'm having a little trouble believing they can pack in there enough liquid helium to last for 10 years. But maybe so, as long as you can keep that particular container cold enough, which plus its insulation determines how fast the helium boils off. And helium must boil off. The pressures it goes to, if you boil it off from the liquid state to the gaseous state, it can produce some tremendous pressures. It'll burst pipes. And so there are times when NASA really has troubles with that. I think there was another email that you had, John. So go ahead with your next one. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
All right, Dick, just to go a little further with Leonard from Brooklyn on his battery question, what do you think if he took a 5K pot, set it for maximum value, put that in series with the battery, hook it up, and adjust it for the correct voltage, and then he would know what type of resistor, fairly close, to put in there. What do you think of something like that?
Good common sense, John, but I think you cannot do that for two reasons. The actual current drain of a battery holding circuit is not constant, and it's a hugely small number. The battery holding circuit that's used on my Kenwood 751A, because mine is 10 or 15 years old and the battery finally went dead and I replaced it. As I replaced that battery, I decided to measure the current, and I went to the lowest current scale in the microampere region of my digital voltmeter, and I couldn't see any current. The way I finally sort of measured the current is to use the fact that my digital voltmeter has an input impedance when it's measuring voltage of 10 megohms. Therefore, if the circuit with the 3-volt coin battery in it was drawing 1 microampere across the 10 megohm impedance would give you a 10 volt drop. Well, the bottom line is with a 10 megohm impedance, the actual voltmeter used in series between the battery and the chip, I think, registered something like 1 volt. So a third of a volt drain on a 10 megohm circuit. So to put a simple series resistor, you can't put a resistor that's big enough that would be reliable. And when you're really calling for the battery to give you the memory function, then it draws some current, and now the voltage would drop too low. So simply putting a resistor in series is not going to do it. To make it a potentiometer, where the resistor goes from the battery to ground and now the slider goes to the circuit, that's undesirable. Let me drop. Because now that potentiometer is going to drain the battery 5 times faster than the circuit does. You're going to be eating into the shelf life of the battery. So you don't want to put a shunt resistor, which is a real potentiometer, and you're not going to get reliability out of a series resistor. So for those reasons, I don't recommend it. I would either run it on 6 volts or 3 volts. I would first do an experiment on 3 volts. As long as the memory is not so extensive, and you've got a list of what frequencies you could load back in, and it's not going to take you a month of Sundays to do it, I would do the 3-volt experiment. I think there's a medium good chance you're going to be pleasantly surprised. The Cadillac solution is to do a reverse engineering. Open up the package, look at the model number on the integrated circuit chip and go to that data sheet, and that'll tell you everything you want to know. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, my next suggestion was going to be to put a model resistor in series with the battery and put it across a 5.5 Zener diode. And so what? The diode will conduct until the battery goes down, but that'll keep it from going to plug.
Yes, but that Zener circuit is going to drain the battery five times faster than its shelf life. You really don't want to put any kind of a shunt impedance across a coin battery that's being used for holding up memory. When everything is working well, that circuit probably draws a nanoampere of current. And you can't put a series resistor in that. And you don't want to put a shunt resistor of any kind. You're going to drain it much faster than the normal use of the circuit. So I don't think you want to put a series resistor. I don't think you want to put a shunt resistor. I don't think you want to put a resistor. That's my opinion, John. Over to you, John.
Okay, Dick. I was just thinking, because once the voltage drops below that level, the diode won't conduct anymore anyway. But okay, if we got it, I got one more for you.
Coolio, Dick.
Yeah, what did you do in that circuit there, Rich?
Yeah, he has to go from 6 volts to 5.7. What about using a germanium diode in series forward bias to get a barrier potential drop of 3/10?
That's the best solution yet. Now the circuit is seeing exactly the voltage it used to see, assuming the 5.7 is not a typographical error, assuming it's a real number. A simple series Zener-like device, or a forward-biased germanium diode, or a Schottky diode, but the right kind of a diode. Now, the voltage sees the right circuit, and you have no excess draining device. And now, that forward-biased diode, if the circuit, when it's doing its memory function, you know, periodically draws 5 milliamps, then it's going to get the 5.7 volts by way of that Zener. You've hit the nail on the head, Rich. That's a beautiful solution. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
I agree, Dick. That sounds perfect.
Yep.
If he gets his 6/10, 7/10 of a volt drop, that'll keep it happy. Okay. If you're ready, I'll go to the next one.
Yeah, a germanium diode has something like a 3/10 of a volt drop. So 6 volts would go down to 5.7. A silicon diode's got around 7/10 of a volt drop. But you gotta be careful now. These voltage drops are when some reasonable amount of current is going through the diode. The circuit is only going to draw nanoamperes. However, if anything's wrong with the circuit where it sees too much volts and therefore draws too much current, then everything is automatically adjusting, if you know what I mean. The diode is still the right solution. However, if you had the right kind of an electrometer, by electrometer I mean a circuit that's got a gig ohm of input impedance, and when that battery plus the 3/10 of a volt drop germanium diode in series with it is connected to the circuit, and now you measure the real voltage with an electrometer, an extremely high impedance circuit, I think you're going to find 6 volts out of the battery and 5.99 volts on the circuit, even though the diode is there. You won't get the normal voltage drop out of the diode. The leakage current of your fingerprint on the diode is going to be a shunt resistor around the diode that's going to give you a higher voltage than you think into the actual integrated circuit chip, because these memory circuits in some cases draw very, very little current. But these are academic issues. You could have a grand old time doing a nice study of this if you want to. KC2WGB, go ahead with the next one, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. I don't think he's going to have any problem even if he uses the 6-volt one, especially on an older piece like that. But at least he has a few things to look at. I like the diode idea. Very good. Next question is from Manawa, New Jersey, from Bob. It's an antenna question. I think I know where he's going with this one. He has a vertical antenna that he's using now, plus he has a spare one. And he has a question about taking the second antenna at the same location and tilting it at 45 degrees. He wonders if he will be able to benefit from what he's heard you talk about as far as horizontal and vertical polarization. And when it is bent, let's say it is bent to, I think this is where he's going, if it is bent toward the south at 45 degrees, would he have directional abilities east to west as he rotates that with a rotor? Get this one. That's an idea. What do you think, Dick?
Before we proceed, do you believe that this is an HF dipole on 80 meters?
No, 2 meters.
It's a 2-meter vertical. It's not a Yagi. I mean, the average guy who wants to direct a 2-meter signal in particular directions tends to use a Yagi. This is a tilted 45-degree angle, 2-meter ground plane antenna mounted on top of a rotator. Is that approximately the view, John? Go ahead.
That's affirmative, Dick, and I believe it's going to be used for reception. I don't think transmission. He understands a little bit. I can tell the way he's writing. But what do you think the effect is going to be?
Yeah, on HF, you would have none of the effects that you would expect. If it was an HF dipole tilted at a 45-degree angle to the south, to the east, almost doesn't matter. When it comes to sky wave propagation, because of Faraday rotation, no matter what polarization you launch, after it's been through that atmosphere and twisted a couple of times, and then arrives at your destination in London or Florida or Chicago or wherever, if it's been through ionosphere, the polarization becomes, to some degree, scrambled. It moves in a deterministic way, and if you've got enough knowledge of the status of the ionosphere today, you can predict what polarization will come back out of that ionospheric. Everybody calls it balance, but it's a really refraction. But now on VHF frequencies, you're not using the ionosphere. You launch a signal at a 45-degree polarization on a VHF antenna in a particular direction. The guy is going to receive a 45-degree polarized signal, not counting ground reflection. Ground reflection does complicate things, and ground reflection is always there. From my point of view, you're not going to get, you're not going to get a lot of benefit out of tilting the ground plane antenna, quarter wave, 5/8 wave, whatever, tilting the ground plane antenna at a 45-degree angle, then putting it on a rotator and rotating it. You're not going to get a lot of benefit out of that.
By the way, it's a half wave.
And by the way, the difference between half wave and 5/8 wave is very minor. Because of the complication of ground bounce and bounce off of buildings, if you want to go to the next step and you get into the fancy words, the environment has chirality. It's a chiral environment. That's a fancy way of saying you launch a clockwise signal and it bounces off the ground. It comes out after the bounce counterclockwise, circular polarization. You launch a signal that's slant 45 in a particular direction. After ground bounce, the ground bounce version is slant 45 the other way. Positive 45 becomes negative 45. So funny things happen in the real world. So in the real world, because of the chirality of the environment, when he's talking to particular repeaters in, say, a metro area, where you've got lots of buildings and water towers and all kinds of things to bounce from, as you rotate this tilted antenna, you will see changes. You will see sometimes the signal getting stronger and sometimes getting weaker from a particular repeater in a particular direction on a particular day. Let me drop.
KC2QIQ with a comment, because I've done this experiment.
Glenn recognized. Yeah. You would like to believe that you stand on top of the roof of your house, you put on the binoculars, you look in the direction of the particular repeater 10 miles away, you got a real good telescope, and you've got line of sight. You'd like to believe whatever signal you launch through that line of sight path is going to arrive exactly that way, day after day. You'd be very disappointed. You put a signal strength meter and a chart recorder on that repeater, and you run this experiment, and you'll find the signal going up and down with all kinds of variations as you go beyond midnight and the summertime dew forms on the grass and the lower levels of the atmosphere, and you get sub-refraction and super-refraction. Sometimes that wave over the 10-mile path is bending downward, bending upward, bending to the left, bending to the right. Funny things happening. So even when you do the experiment of taking the tilt of the antenna and rotating it, what you see on 10 o'clock in the morning in the summer versus 2 o'clock in the morning after midnight is going to be kind of different. Let's see what Glenn has done. I bet you when you were in Florida, you did some of these experiments, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, I actually, Dick, and not only that, I've done a lot of them since I've been up here in New York, and actually, like, within the last few years, especially doing a lot of mobile antenna experimentations, and one of them was taking either the halfway vertical mounted or the 5/8 way vertical mounted and tilting it at 45 degrees, and here's what I viewed happens. At all angles around a ground plane vehicle, what I actually see is vertical polarization on all axes. I didn't change the polarization by bending it in 45 degrees. What I did do, however, is when the antenna is completely straight up and down vertical, there's a takeoff angle from the antenna that's basically, especially on the 5/8, that's nice and flat. So you have a very, very good view over the horizon flat on a 5/8 wave antenna or half-wave antenna. When you tilt it over to one side, what happens is you elevate the takeoff angle on one side, so it becomes a high takeoff angle. On the other side, it becomes a low takeoff angle, pointing towards the ground. And then on either side, it almost looks the same as if it was straight up and down. Isn't that crazy, Dick? K4IW, KC2QIQ.
If I did that experiment, Glenn, with a Yagi antenna, which really has a great big long Yagi, would have a pencil beam, and I aimed the Yagi to the west, because my friend is to the west and he's 10 miles away, and I aim at 10 degrees below the horizon. Common sense would say, hey, I'm launching the signal and it's going out below the horizon. Not really. After that ground bounce, I mean, you and I look at that dirt in the backyard and we see dirt. That radio wave sees something that's close to a mirror. It's a very rough mirror on 2 meters, but it's still a mirror. In other words, if I stand off half a mile and look back toward my antenna, I see the real antenna above the ground. I see a mirror image of that antenna below the ground. When you aim the antenna into the ground, all you've really done is to make the mirror image stronger than the direct image, but there's still a mirror image. So tilting it, you thought you were launching the signal down into the ground. As you can tell, I'm skeptical of that. You believed you were launching the signal down into the ground. If you actually went out there with a helicopter and took signal strength readings as you went up and down with the helicopter, and you did this at each compass heading, I think you'd find out that your elevation pattern is quite a bit different than you think. And you would think you're launching a lower signal closer to the horizon because you tilted it into the ground. I don't think so. Over to you, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Okay, this is what we actually observed with it, and with quite a few people actually monitoring while I was doing it. The end of the antenna that gets tilted up in the air, the reason I say the takeoff angle goes up is because when the antenna was straight vertical up and down, I had a very, very nice takeoff angle in all angles, vertically polarized. So what was basically happening was that I had very, very good, almost, you could say, DX along the horizon all the way around. When I tilted the antenna down off on one side, it basically what I started doing was I started losing the DX off in that direction where it was tilted up, and I could only get the near stations coming in from that end. So in other words, it became a close-in antenna where the antenna was pointed up, and I had something similar that was happening when it was pointed down on the opposite side, but there was a spot missing in the middle, and then I could hear DX again beyond that first point. But side to side, it was as if nothing was different. So that was basically the effect that we were seeing when the antenna gets tilted over in 45 degrees. But when anybody was trying to measure the signal, whether I sounded stronger vertical or horizontal, it was always strongest still in vertical. Never got like 45 or anywhere near horizontal, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Let's assume now that that antenna is tilted at a 45 degree angle toward the west, and you've got a guy out there in the west 20 miles away or 100 miles away. I think you were doing this on VHF, but maybe HF. And now, that guy to the west, if you compare straight up to when it's tilted 45 degrees toward him, what did he see, Glenn? Back to you, Glenn.
When the antenna was tilted towards towards a direction, what would happen is I would only get very, very good copy within, say, 5 miles at ground level. So in other words, the first 5 miles or so, I had direction. Then a spot was missing in between, like between, say, 5 and 25, 30 miles. But then a little bit all the way at the extreme, I started hearing signals again. So it was as if there was a gap missing in the middle when the antenna was tilted down towards the ground. On the opposite side, there was the where it was tilted away from, I could only get signals maybe out, maybe like 8 to 10 miles max. And then everything after that was just a dead zone. Back to you, Dick.
Huh. What frequency were you doing that experiment on, Glenn?
There was like on simplex 146 5052 around that area.
Yeah, the main thing I want to know is did you do it on HF or VHF? You were doing it on 2 meters. Huh. Not quite what I would have expected. Not clear. And tilted toward the guy, I can see how the direct sky wave out of the antenna is going to be de-emphasized, the ground bends is going to be emphasized, and maybe that created the skip zone that you experienced. What you described, some people would call it a skip zone. You talked out to 6 miles, and it was a gap, and then it came back again. And how it came back again is not easy to explain, because it would sound like you're getting an ionospheric reflection. Well, on 2 meters, 99% of the time, there is no ionospheric reflection. Huh. So, do you think there's any simple explanation, Glenn, as to when the tilt is toward the direction? Why is there a skip zone, and why does it come back again? How in the world did it come back without ionospheric reflection? Was it possible you had super high humidity, you're doing this in Florida, and you're getting some kind of super refraction effects, where the wave is tending to bend downward naturally because of the atmosphere, what the atmosphere is doing, the tropospheric layer? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Actually, this experiment was done right here in New York, and I had done it like multiple times, and you can see even by listening to local stations, when you tilt the antenna away from even a local station, you can see the gain actually change on the S meter as you tilt it over. But then it's not changing in polarity. It's just basically it's as if the takeoff angle of the antenna seems to be going up into the sky as you're tilting it down from the opposite end. And on the other end, it's going down. So, but what's really interesting, and I just view that as takeoff angle, but what's really interesting is that side to side, it virtually makes no difference at all, which is, I think, a little bit easier to understand that side to side there's no difference. But it is interesting how the far side, that, you know, where you know it's where you're moving the antenna away from, it gets very, very short on that side. But the skip zone on the other side, I'm not really sure myself. But that was done right here on Long Island, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
If the antenna is mounted on top of a rotator, on top of a tower, a fairly pure environment, what you just described is not easy to explain. If the antenna was mounted on the chimney of a house, which means you've got a whole lot of other hardware nearby, as you tilt the antenna toward or away from the direction of the guy you're talking to, you're really moving the phase center of the antenna, the point of apparent emission, moving it closer to him and further from him, only by a foot or so, but depending on the hardware that's around it, you move the phase center, and the reflection off that hardware changes in ways that are favorable and unfavorable. So the physical translation of the phase center of the antenna is another variable complicating the issue. From your point of view, Glenn, how pure was the environment around the antenna where you mounted it during that experiment? Over to you, Glenn.
Okay, let me explain the experiment a little bit better. These are PL259 mobile mounted dual band antennas. In other words, two meter, 70 centimeter antennas. And the antenna mount was a magnetic mount in the middle of my Jeep's roof. So it's a metal roof right in the middle, and I had a little adapter that goes that screws into the PL259 mount that basically I can tighten it up and basically rotate the antenna and tilt it over. So in other words, I can basically take the whole antenna and tilt it over basically almost into the horizontal position. And what was interesting was that when you actually move it all the way practically horizontal against the car body, the antenna is just not an antenna anymore. It just really detunes and operates horrible. But what's interesting is that when you go anywhere from about, say, 25 degrees off of the roof of the car, this property basically takes place to somewhere until you get to within, say, 10 degrees of perfectly vertical on the car. And there was basically, it side to side, it tends to work okay, but like towards the where the antenna is tilted away, it tends to just basically have a very, very high takeoff angle, and you only get very, very close in stations. And it's a very similar effect even on the area where the antenna is tilted down, except for this, the oddity that it did seem to pick up again in the forward distance again. But it might have been because of reflections off the car body there again, too, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, you didn't tell us that. The fact that this is done on top of an automobile, very different environment than I had pictured. Just taking the mag mount, pure vertical, and taking it in the center of the roof of the car, moving it to the forward left-hand side, right above the driver's head, moving it to the forward right-hand side, above the passenger's head, moving it to the rear right and the rear left, just those translations of the antenna, while it is purely vertical all the time, would have changed the azimuthal pattern of the antenna significantly, because the IEEE has discovered that the antenna tends to fire in the direction of the major mass of the car. So just translating would have made significant differences. Now when you're doing tilting, you're moving the phase center of the antenna across the roof of that car, which is a kind of translation. So you're affecting polarization effects, phase center, location effects. The automobile is doing funny things. And for all you know, that skip zone, would that be repeating from day to day, that so-called skip zone? And for it to come back again, that's not easy to explain. But 2 meter propagation from day to day can change quite a bit. I mean, there are times when Paul hears a very weak signal from the 2585 repeater, the W2VL repeater. Let me drop.
Excuse me, Dick, before you go any further, this is an experiment that is so easy for you to do. You can do it yourself on an afternoon and just use repeaters as your source and just do it as receiving. Just try receiving repeaters and listen and tilt your antenna and watch the results. It's extremely repeatable. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
The right way to do it would be to choose a great big parking lot that's got very flat land around it. You know, a great big...
How's the Jones Beach big parking lot door sound?
There you go. Go to Jones Beach, mount this antenna in various positions, and now drive the vehicle in circles in the parking lot while picking up individual repeaters in various directions. That would be a very interesting experiment. Properly done and properly documented, that could be a master's thesis, if you know what I mean, as a propagation study. So, were you driving the vehicle in the Jones Beach parking lot in circles while doing this, Glenn? Go ahead.
It's one of my favorite places to test antennas and, you know, mount them without a lot of obstructions and really good idea of propagation patterns. It's good for doing HF stuff down there, VHF stuff down there. I'm walking around with HTs and checking them, checking directional Doppler antennas. It's my miniature antenna range, so to speak, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Although this is very far off subject, and this is a gallows humor, while you're doing these drives to and from the parking lot of Jones Beach and you're on that main road, keep an eye out for anybody that parks the car up to one side of the road and is bringing a burlap bag of something into the woods, if you know what I mean.
there's been quite a few bodies discovered over the last three quarters of a year or so. You know what I'm talking about, Glenn? Go ahead.
That's why I carry my cell phone with me, Dick.
Okay. And when the gendarmes come, because you're doing this experiment in the parking lot in the wintertime, and they say, what in the world are you doing here? And you try to explain, I'm running this experiment on ham radio. I guarantee they'll look at you kind of funny.
Oh. They know me already by now, Dick.
Uh-oh. I'm not sure I want to go with you. That's good, Glenn. Fun experiment. And not everything is easy to explain, as you can tell, John. KC2WGV, K2RIW.
Very good, Dick. You're right. Bob in Mahwah, New Jersey, doesn't realize what box he's opened here. Not Pandora's box, but a lot of boxes, a lot of questions. Alrighty, that's about it from Mel's Corner. And we'll see what happens next week. And when you get around to it, I have a question also.
Yeah, I forgot that I put you on the list. Right now, go ahead with your question, John.
Dick, last year, about the middle of the year, you and I spoke about putting up two Yagis vertically polarized. Okay, and they'll be on a T-bar. And I'm thinking of bringing down two independent lines and to use it as a phased array like you had suggested. Can I use a trombone inside the shack for the tuning for the phased array?
There's a reason why. There's a reason why it sounds this way, but I don't want to... I'll tell you on the phone. If you call me, I can tell you what's going on.
Andy, W-A-2-C-D-L, are you hearing us right now? We're hearing you.
Sorry about that. Okay. Call me on the phone.
Who are you talking to, Andy, saying call you on the phone? Andy, are you hearing me? I think Andy's coming through a link that he's not afraid, he's not aware of that he's coming through. Okay. Let's assume now that your two Yagis, two vertically polarized Yagis, each have, let me pick a number, 45 degrees of horizontal beamwidth. And now, you've got these two Yagis side by side. Both of them aim north in my experiment. And now, I take the two separate cables from the two separate Yagis. One of them goes through a trombone. And now the two of them come together into some kind of a power summing device. One way to do it, if you want the Cadillac approach, would be to sum them with a real power divider, a Wilkinson hybrid, a quadrature hybrid, or whatever. But you could do the experiment by just bringing them together in a T connector, and then the common port goes to the receiver and an S meter. As you operate the trombone, you can electronically steer that beam plus and minus 90 degrees. Let me drop.
And it's for 2 meters, by the way, Dick.
Exactly. When I chose a 45-degree beamwidth on a 2-meter Yagi, that's probably a 4- or 5-element Yagi on 2 meters, something that's very doable. You can do it with coat hanger wire. So you got a pair of these Yagis. They're probably 8 feet apart. I'm rounding off the numbers a whole lot. But maybe the two antennas are 7 or 8 feet apart. Each one of them is a 5-element Yagi on 2 meters. Each individual Yagi has got a 45-degree beamwidth. By way of the trombone, you can steer the beam plus or minus 90 degrees. That's a given, but there's a catch. When you've got the trombone set in such a way that the beam coming out of it, the electronic beam, is boresighted, it's aimed dead north. You're getting full gain out of both Yagis because they are physically aimed north. Assume now that let me round off the numbers, but assume that your Yagis were 50 degrees wide, plus or minus 25 degrees. That's the half power beamwidth of the Yagi. Now you take the two individual cables from the Yagis, one of them through a trombone, into the power summing device, which could be a T connector, and you start operating the trombone so that you're electronically steering the beam 45 degrees to the left or the right on this, let's see now, It's a 50 degree enter, plus or minus 25 degrees. You steer the beam electronically 25 degrees. Without a doubt, the beam will go there. There's a catch. Let me drop. Every phased array has a element pattern and an array pattern. The individual Yagis aim to the north, and each individual Yagi, in my example, are 50 degrees wide. That is the element pattern. Each Yagi is an element of the phased array. Each Yagi is 50 degrees wide, plus or minus 25 degrees. That's the array. That's the element pattern. The way you phase the individual cables and their delay times is the element, is the array pattern. You steer the array pattern toward plus or minus 45 degrees. It will go there. But each individual antenna in that direction is 3 dB down. That's the half-power beamwidth. So the beam will go there. The beam will be 3 dB weaker when it goes there. Now you could decide to steer not plus or minus 25 degrees in my example, 50-degree wide antenna. You could steer plus or minus 40 degrees electronically, whatever the skirt of the individual antenna patterns, maybe the antenna pattern down there, that far away from the bore site of the individual Yagis, maybe it's 6 dB down. The beam will go there, but it'll be 6 dB weaker. A phased array, the individual directions and signal strengths and whatever, is the multiplication of the element pattern and the array pattern. You know what the array pattern would be? You make believe that each individual antenna, let me drop. You draw yourself a diagram, a computer-generated plot, where you make each individual antenna of the two antennas isotropic. And now you combine the two signals, one from a trombone, and that is the array pattern. You steer the trombone in all the possible directions, and you look at all the patterns you can get, and in that particular case, all the lobes will have almost the exact same strength of the array pattern. Now you superimpose on top of that the element pattern. Draw it on top of the array pattern diagram, and the element pattern you've drawn in black, the array pattern you've drawn in red. You take out your scissors and you cut off. You cut the piece of paper around the red diagram that you've just drawn. So in each one of those directions, the signal gets weaker because you're off the bore site of the individual Yagis. When your individual elements have directivity of their own, like a Yagi, you have to multiply those two patterns together, mathematically multiply. What does that really mean? You take the voltage in that particular direction of the array pattern, the voltage in that particular direction of the element pattern, multiply those two voltages together. You've normalized one of them. Multiply those two voltages together, then convert that voltage back into power, or dBs, and you know how strong is the lobe going to be in that direction. The bottom line, as you can see, is that as you go to higher and higher gain Yagis, the amount of electronic steering you can use and be useful does get smaller. Now, let me drop. But as you make the array bigger and bigger, you can make it in such a way that the array pattern becomes a very fine pencil beam, and within that great big lobe of the individual elements of the element pattern looks like a watermelon out there. But inside of that, you could, with the array, make these very sharp pencil beams and steer back and forth. Now, if you were doing an experiment where you're looking at the reflection off the aurora curtain, and I've done this on 432, and I'm getting a very sharp point source reflection at 432 off the aurora curtain with the antenna aimed essentially to the north, and I was using a 5-degree beamwidth antenna, and I could swish the antenna mechanically left and right 5 degrees and watch that signal go up and down in signal strength real fast and watch the Doppler shifts go up and down, because those electrons coming in to the North Pole area in that aurora, they come down in a spiral. And I was looking at the Doppler shift when I was left of the hot spot or right of the hot spot. So electronically being able to steer, the nice advantage of the electronic steering, if you've got the right kind of electronics, is you can electronically steer in a microsecond, whereas to mechanically revolve your T-bar is going to take multiple seconds. So there's times when that has a real advantage. So there's goods and bads, and there's some limitations. I wonder if that makes some sense, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
it does make a lot of sense. I just wanted to touch base with you on that before I got a trombone. I have the two Yagis ready to go. I hope this spring I can finally get that up, and I think that'll be an interesting experiment. Okay, that's about it for me. Oh, by the way, did you get the pictures I mailed you today? I emailed you some pictures of the 805.
I'm going to take a look right now, and I remember, do I remember seeing your picture? So far, I don't. Sure enough. Wow. Turns out that your return, I'm now seeing pictures of your lab. The very first picture is the 805 trombone. I recognize it. I see a pair of them, cascaded. One is gray in color, one is white in color, by comparison. I see them connected together. I'm looking at the second, the third picture. Yeah, beautiful pictures of that trombone. Are those going to be part of your QRZ.com website? And I see, on the very first picture, I see a T connector on the far left-hand side and a piece of coax cable going up toward the ceiling. So give me some words as to what I'm seeing there, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, that heavy cable, believe it or not, that's a $1,200 cable. It goes up to the Gigatronics generator. That's feeding that first dark ray 805. Then it goes into the second one. If you notice at the end of the second one, there's an antenna on that. And I did, by the way, find the error, and I corrected it. That's why I had listed that as calibration of the 805. It was out 2.5 thousandths. I found it with a dial indicator, my LS Barrett dial indicator. It was 2.5 thousandths out. That was the error, which was being multiplied out to a half a millimeter.
The error was when what, John? The probe coming out of the carriage was tilted. What was the actual physical error? Go ahead.
Yes, Dick. The error was the probe itself on the dark gray one was eccentric. It was traveling. If I rotated it, it did show on the dial indicator. Could not see it with a square, though.
And as you know, that so-called error could be academic, because the way a person often uses a slotted line is he puts a known short open load or whatever. He puts a known thing at the end. He moves the carriage until he finds those particular nulls. They become the reference point. Then he puts the unknown device in that exact same location and then finds out where the null moves and what the new standing wave ratio is. And with proper interpretation, he now knows the exact impedance of the new thing he put on by comparison to the calibration, the short open and load with the calibration. So because it is a normalized or delta measurement as opposed to a absolute measurement of direction of the position of the carriage, what you call an error in the real use really isn't an error, but you're enough of a scientist, you wanted to find out what the difference was. Back to you, John, K2RIW.
You're right, Dick, and the measurements I make, that half a millimeter is not going to make any difference, but it was just bothering me, and I was swapping them back and forth, and I found that out. I didn't try to straighten it because I thought I would do, 2.5 thousandths. That's a tough correction to make without going too far. You never know what happens. And by the way, if you look over the light 805, the light colored one, directly above that, that's that Wavetech 178 that we were talking about, the generator, function generator.
Now, your main signal generator with that very expensive piece of vertical cable comes down to what looks like a T-connector, and I'm not quite sure what's on the other port of the T-connector. Is that just some kind of an open circuit cap? What's on that other port of the T-connector, which you're using as a right-angle adapter, as I see it? Like, apparently you didn't have a right-angle type-N connector. What's on that other port of the T-connector, John? Go ahead.
Dick, that was used to go to the spectrum analyzer and to the oscilloscope when I was looking to detect the 1 KC and 400 cycle tone from the Gigatronics. That was monitoring the input.
Yeah, a slightly more pure way.
would be to have a sniffer, a sampler, a directional coupler on that cable going into the slotted line. Then there would be a pure 50 ohm signal generator cable, 50 ohm directional coupler going into your slotted line. By way of that T connector that goes over to your other instrumentation, you have a significant standing wave on the cable going back to the signal generator. With fixed frequency operation, no problem. As you sweep the frequency of the signal generator, because you got VSWR on that feeding cable, life gets a little bit more complicated, if you know what I mean. And let me think, is there another thing that we should know about? Yeah, there are certain kinds of measurements where you would like any signal that reflects back through the slotted line toward the signal generator. You would like the signal generator to absorb all of those signals. You would like the signal generator side of the slotted line to be a pure 50 ohm source. When it's not a 50 ohm source and you've got a 2-to-1 VSWR on the input end, any signal reflecting back from the device on the test through the slotted line and coming back to the T connector, because of the 2-to-1, that reflected signal is going to re-reflect forward. Therefore, during swept frequency tests, life is more complicated. You're not doing a swept frequency test. Very few people do with a slotted line. But you see where I'm going with that one. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yes, Dick, when I normally use the slotted line, I use a right angle connector. I use that to preview the signal going in to make sure that everything is exactly, I know the voltage, I know what it looks like, I know the shapes. That's where, then I take that T connector off, and I just put my right angle connector on. Just a little double check. And in fact, you can see a sniffer I built sitting on top of the light colored 805 on the left hand corner of it. If you look there, you'll see a little dark thing. I don't know if you got a big enough picture to be able to see it. That's a sniffer, which is works at quite a few different frequencies. It only has 15 turns and number 30 wire onto a BNC connector. It works beautifully.
Is that a WGB homebrew rubber duck? I see the gray object on the left-hand corner of the white picture, of the white slotted line, which is picture number 2. I see it very clearly. Is that a WGB-made rubber duck? And do you sometimes slip that down into the slotted line just to see what would happen? Go ahead.
Oh, definitely. It's been in there. I have made quite a few. This one has 15 turns and about 30. Then I made one with 30 turns. I made another one with 10 turns. And all I did was make a loop of wire, solder it onto the BNC with some tie wraps holding it in a circle, slipped some heat shrink on it, heated it up, and now I have 3 or 4 of these sniffers, and they work very well. I think anybody who's doing any kind of little troubleshooting or experimenting, that's a great device to use because you can't harm your equipment and you can really find signals.
What was your motivation for making one of them 15 turns and one 30 turns and so on, to go to lower and higher?
You cut out there for a minute. I assume you meant lower or higher frequencies. Is that correct?
The machine just went into a mode where I have to turn my TL tone back on. Otherwise, you don't hear me. Let me double check that.
Right, it's 11 o'clock. That's what they do.
Sure enough, the tone's got to be turned on. And that's exactly right. You made them, my audio is now lower. You made them a different number of turns for lower and higher frequencies, and I guess you use them for troubleshooting. In other words, you look for extraneous signals. There it is. You look for extraneous signals on the circuit board, for instance, with that. Quite often at VHF frequencies, people will use as a sniffer a piece of coax cable with a loop, one single loop at the end, which is about a half inch in diameter, where the center conductor loops back and is soldered to the shield. That kind of a sniffer is more frequently used than the rubber duck type. Your rubber duck type is a little bit more of a broad response physical. In other words, where's the signal really coming from? I guess when you touch the tip to the right part of the printed circuit board, that becomes, because of proximity, the most sensitive place that tells you where the signal is coming from. Is that approximately right, John? Go ahead.
Yes. You see, the system with the single loop on the end of the coax is okay if you're using very thin coax, and I've done that with some of the coax I've